Now, Thursdays in the second hour of our program means our history class with our professor, John DeMoya from the Seoul National University, joins us in the studio. Professor DeMoya, thank you very much for joining us this evening.
Thank you very much for having me.
Today's an interesting topic because usually, we cover all the history post-Korean War. During Korea War or post-Korea War, contemporary modern Korean history, right?
Today's
a little different, though. We're going to be going into something that happened before that. And of course, for many of us here in Korea, but also nowadays, many people around the world are very much familiar with the South Korean flag. But the circumstances under which the colorful symbol became a national emblem actually remain less well known. So the big question is, how under what conditions was the current flag adopted? What has it become to mean to Koreans? And what are some of the meanings beyond the immediate national symbolism? We'll talk about all that and more. But Professor, just to start things off here, has Korea always had a national flag?
No, certainly not in the contemporary sense of first Taegukgi and in the nation state sense that we think of South Korea today. As we'll talk in just a few moments, the with slight variations flag that is now South Korea's was adopted at some point in the second half of the 19th century under some rather interesting circumstances.
Mm-hmm. And so we're talking about, because you would assume that being that Korea was at once a kingdom.
Right.
Right. With the king. I can't imagine having a flag because I've watched my share of my historical dramas. And sure, there was some flags here and there, but none that that were kind of familiar with. But let's talk about what the Schufeld Treaty was. What's this all about?
Sure. This is the set of circumstances under which late Joseon Korea, less than, you know, not a short time period before we get to the Joseon Empire,
mm-hmm.
Is going to negotiate with the United States just only a few years after 1876 and Kangwa dealt with Japan. The reason I'm going to mention Japan is when Japan, quote unquote, opens up Korea, and we know that's controversial,
There
is no Korean national flag. And while this doesn't have any immediate impact upon the negotiations, there is kind of some discussion of, wait a minute, like why don't we have a flag in terms of going to the table and doing these negotiations?
Mm-hmm.
And this similarly comes up in the context of Schufeld, which is now 1882, 6 years later, negotiating with the Americans. And again, larger context, this is a period in which Korea is seeing any number of these kinds of negotiations, recognizing that it needs to begin adopting some of the trappings of these other nations, not only in terms of the flag, but if you've ever seen the pictures, and if you haven't, they're wonderful. By the 1890s, Kojong will have something of a uniform that looks kind of, you know, with shoulder epaulettes, and that doesn't become famous, but the flag becomes part of, we're going to be negotiating with these other powers. We are still considering ourselves an empire, but we ought to have some sort of representative symbol. So if the treaty is immediately, sorry to go back, about negotiating with the United States about the terms between Joseon and the United States, it is recommended at this point that maybe we should have a flag. We didn't have one a couple years earlier. We're going to continue to have these engagements. We need something to represent who we are and, you know, sort of bring it to the table.
My question is, why, if you want to discuss having a flag and maybe being more immersed with the rest of the international community, that you have to sit down with the United States and have some sort of treaty in order for that to happen?
Oh, yeah, sure. I don't think it's so much that you needed to have a treaty happen. I think it's that under the circumstances of the treaty, and doing a little bit of the background reading for this week, it apparently says that the United States even said to them, like, kind of along the lines of, like, don't you guys have a flag? Like, maybe you ought to have one. And again, recognizing that they did not several years earlier, this, you know, came to the Koreans thinking as, oh, well, we should do this. And this was not something that happens overnight. This is also discussed in terms of the United States, some discussions with Qing China in terms of, okay, we have a relationship with you too. We're also East Asian. What types of symbols, what types of elements need to go into this that will eventually come to be not exactly the same, but relatively close to the Taegukgi that we have today, will be adopted in 1883.
Can we then agree that maybe through the Schufeld Treaty, this is sort of Korea's, and at this time, we're talking about Korea. There is no South Korea. There is no
Correct.
North
it's
Korea.
It's the Korean Peninsula as Joseon right. Korea, yeah.
Right, exactly. So at the time, this is when, I guess, we begin to get westernized in some ways? Because you made an interesting point with the uniform that King Gojong was wearing.
Which, again, I think a lot of Koreans probably haven't seen, but I've had to teach this to students, so the pictures always come up.
And in fact, every time we look up Gojong, the uniform actually always pops up for me.
Which
is very different from all the other kings in the past,
Precisely.
Where you have the royal.
Because this is him emerging into the international forum in a new way.
So then let's talk about that. This kind of changes things. I guess having a flag in itself, a symbol that you are a country and that you are being represented by this very flag. How and why was the flag first adopted, though?
Oh, yeah, sure. It's adopted, I can't give you the exact date, but it's 1883. Mm-hmm. It is adopted in the post-process of discussing and negotiation with the Shufelt circumstances. Coming out of that, there's some negotiation with Qing China. What they ultimately adopt will be, again, I believe there are small differences, because I know the Taeguki even now has changed between, as we'll talk in a few moments, the Joseon version, the version that the provisional government will use in Shanghai, and then the government that South Korea will use. But essentially, these elements of the white background representing, in some sense, peace or purity. I've seen other references to traditional clothing and white clothing being sort of a traditional color. The Taeguk, the red and the blue, representing sort of a balance and a positive and negative energy. And then the four trigrams. And I got to admit, there are numerous references to these meanings. But in essence, the four classical elements, some version of the cardinal directions, northeast, southwest, the different elements of the heavens, different celestial bodies. But again, all of these elements drawn from a different part of Korea's past coming together in this symbol that will now be in the late 19th century. And I want to be careful here, too. I don't know if I would call this westernized so much as responding in someone else's language to. So you know what I mean? Like it's changing slowly.
Yeah.
And in the same way, I don't know. I don't think historians would call this Korea a nation state yet. But it's an empire or a kingdom undergoing the transformative stages of eventually later on becoming a nation state.
So the flag in itself was not designed strictly based on what Korea wanted, but they had to get some input from other countries.
I was just going
to
say, what I've read is that particularly, in fact, Qing China was more, I mean, it's funny, more suggestive of saying, like, why don't you incorporate some Chinese elements, which I guess, yeah, exactly, which was not, but it was at least in talking and discussing with these other parties that probably these Korean elements were selected, appealing obviously mostly to a Korean audience, but also being aware that they would need to be able to performatively explain and sell these elements to these other partners that they were interacting with.
There's something about the Taeguki, when you look at it, seems so simple yet very complicated with different meetings that you talk about there. I mean, you look at Japan, for instance, probably one of the most simple flags.
But also, in its own case, much more controversial, and as you know.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And so it also has a deeper meanings behind
this.
Let's talk about what were the circumstances of the adoption of the flag initially.
Sure. I guess I'll put it in the larger political context, not so much Shufelt itself, because, I mean, this is, 1876, Kongwa with the Japanese, 1882 with the Americans, and then this adoption of the flag coming after that. But the larger context of transformation of late Joseon Korea moving into the Taehan Chaeguk, the Korean, so-called the Great Korean Empire.
Mm-hmm.
Korea is surrounded by powers. They have seen what has been happening to China, Qing China, the second half of the 19th century. They, of course, we don't want to be too anticipatory, but they know that Meiji Japan is growing stronger. So they're adopting these symbols and these rituals, and the uniform, I guess, is part of the package too.
Mm-hmm.
And even just in a few years in the 1890s, the reforms that come with Kabo, in an attempt to transform society, in an attempt to build multiple partnerships, and most importantly, to stave off what ultimately, unfortunately, does happen, which is colonial rule. Things like this. You figure, like anyone, the more friends I have, the more partners I can play off of each other. The famous idea of, in English, the shrimp among whales was the way it was explained to me when I was a graduate student. Even today, Korea is still surrounded by China, Russia, Japan, and very much at the end of the 19th century. So not to suggest that the flag is strictly a response to that, but it's coming out of that cultural mix of how do we transform ourselves into a place that has multiple friends, all the trappings that they understand, and no one will want to bother us, and we'll be able to kind of continue to coexist peacefully among these different friends.
We talk about, Korea for a very long time, a very isolated country.
Sure, that's obviously an outsider perception, but yes.
Right, and surrounded, like you said, by the world powers in China, exactly. And Japan and Russia and so forth. But of all the Joseon kings, mm-hmm. I mean, there's a long list of Joseon kings. You can start off from, obviously Lee Seung-gae, Taejo Lee Seung-gae, and the very last king of the Joseon dynasty being Gojong. Gojong, probably one of the more controversial figures,
sure.
Because of what becomes the colonialism of Japan, Korea being taken over by Japan and so forth. But we can say that under the open ideas, minds of Gojong, this is when Korea is going, we need to start adjusting to the rest of the world. And the rest of the world was changing, whereas you look at the previous Joseon dynasty, I mean, let's face it, hanbok, kings wearing the traditional royal hanbok, you have the all the ways of the olden days, and he's kind of broken out of that.
Yeah, could I possibly just throw out a few examples here? Sure. I don't teach this a lot because I am definitely one of these historians who's a modernist, and I have to admit I'm a little bit uncomfortable when I get to a lot like early to mid Joseon, but late Joseon, and this I'm taking from friends from UCLA. You have the introduction of a very small scale phone system, I think primarily in Seoul, and their pictures of it. You have the first trams at the end of the 19th century, mm-hmm. and the wonderful stories, of course, about the first people to be then in tram accidents because they're not familiar with traffic.
Right.
The first electrical lighting, I think it's Toksogong. So yes, Gojong is not only adopting new clothing, new rituals, but very much, I don't know if he personally, but certainly people around him, adopting the newer technologies in Seoul that would be not only common to these other countries, but again, that would, as you said, plug Korea into a very different kind of world.
You know, one thing I heard about it, I might be kind of getting sidetracked with this, but we are talking about the changes that we're going to be witnessing under Gojong.
Sure.
And he is apparently, and any of our listeners, do correct me if I'm wrong. If you know this, you could correct me too. I heard he was amongst the very first Koreans to enjoy drinking coffee. He accepted.
I got to be honest. I don't know, but it sounds that it fits the rest of the package.
So Korea,
I had not heard that.
South Korea now, if you go everywhere, there's just coffee cafes everywhere. Sure. Everyone's drinking coffee,
but apparently I have to admit, that's part of the experience for me.
Yeah, yeah. And I believe the olden days, the word for coffee was kabe. Was what it was.
Okay.
And so he had this, again, he fell in love with coffee. And then I don't know how you could when you first drink it, to be honest with you. But he is probably the first to kind of, bring that about. And again, going back into the whole idea of accepting what's outside, because Korea being a very isolated country, they were kind of rejecting all outside forces, even including ideas, traditions, goods, and so forth. And we're seeing a change in that. We talked about the various colors and the elements mm-hmm. symbolizing mm-hmm. the flag in itself, but I want to ask you, has the flag represented Korea in more than one iteration does it represent only South Korea, I guess?
No, and this is where it gets both interesting and more controversial. So yeah, we definitely know that this flag with small changes was used by late Joseon, then by the Taehyung Jaeguk, the great Korean Empire. Mm-hmm. Then it will be picked up once colonialism comes by the provisional Korean government in Shanghai. And that is probably one of the reasons why the South Korean government picks it up and adopts it for 1948. The point being that it represents all of these Koreas. Now, where it gets controversial to Koreans, and I'm explaining this so listeners might not know this, is it implies a continuity among all of those different governments, mm-hmm. that's the one Korea. Obviously, North Korea might have something to say about that.
So that's the thing that I was going to ask, North Korea?
Is South Korea the right only inheritor of the Joseon government, which of course the South Korean government wants to say, but historians might check. Yes, and absolutely North Korea, and if there's ever a Tongil or anything like that, this will represent all kinds of interesting problems about how to reintegrate North Korea under those terms.
You remember a couple of weeks ago, we were talking about the bilateral relations that was being formed with South Korea and Kenya.
Yeah.
And how, looking at it,
delegitimized the other Korea.
Oh, yo, absolutely. And so by having more bilateral relations with more number of countries, means that you are the legitimate Korea. I wonder if there was any time where the South Korean government kind of used the argument, Look, I mean, we've been using this Tegaki that's been around since day one. We are the legitimate
Korea. I'll say this. I have not looked at diplomatic conversations, but I'm convinced that in discussions up until 48, that they certainly looked at it as the provisional government's pickup, and probably from there, looking back to the Taehyung Chaeguk and said, well, it's post-colonial. We want to go back to the last thing we had before colonialism. That is the Taehyung Chaeguk. Let's sort of reboot the government. And again, that's not even talking about the complicated circumstances of division that are coming. But yeah, you are already kind of saying, like, if you want to be legitimate in Korean, gather together under this flag. And that happens to be what becomes South Korea in August 48. I'm sure they thought about it. It's not accidental.
But at the same time, I almost feel like Kim Il-sung would want a flag for himself, you know? Basically say, we're starting something new. What we had in the past was wrong. And because, you know, Korea...
Absolutely. And given that for whatever we say about him, and by the way, I want to be really careful here, I am not, you know, praising, I'm not a fan of North Korea.
No.
But recognizing that he was a legitimate kind of rebel in a certain part of Manchuria and that in the 30s.
Right.
Yeah. He sees South Korean government as very much puppets, illegitimate in his own term. So, yes, he would want to go a different way.
Yeah.
And it's just that looking later, the South Koreans made a really smart choice.
Yeah. I mean, if you look at what goes on and, you know, communism just kind of striking, you know, towards right before the Korean War, at the end of the Japanese colonialism, you have a lot of, poverty up in the northern side, and hence the communist idea spreading around. And so they're saying, well, if we had this communist idea in the past, this would have never happened. And so not surprised, I would not be surprised if there was actually no bickering going on who's going to take the Tegaki.
Oh, you mean in terms of like 48? Yeah, I've never seen anything about the North Korea saying, wait, you have no claim to that.
I just meant
now, thinking longer historically, it does create all kinds of problems for... perfect example. Because I teach this to students all the time.
Sure,
if you ask
sure.
them, when does the South Korean nation exist? It's perfectly legitimate to answer 1948. Some people say it's perfectly legitimate to answer 1919 because Samil Undong represents the beginning of the national uprising. So, I mean, and again, that in 2019, the 100th anniversary, there were lots of newspaper editorials about, let's celebrate the 100th anniversary of the nation. So, again, historians look at this probably in a way that listeners might not, but it's not a question with a single answer.
As someone in South Korea,
sure,
right, looking at the Tegaki and looking at the long history of how it started off and how it could have easily, I think, during maybe the Korean War, or the separation of South and North Korea happened even before the Korean War, as we talked about in the past,
48.
That they could have easily said, we're going to create another flag.
Yeah, we want to restart. We want to go a different way. Sure,
right, exactly.
Sure,
and
sure.
So when you have, and I don't know how things were. I think Germany, when they had East and West Germany, did they have different flags?
I'll be honest with you. I have not looked, but my instinct would be to say yes.
Right.
Just that the Federal Republic and the DRG are very different places.
Yeah. And so you would think that they would have different flags, and South Korea could have easily gone, you know what, we're going to start all new.
Yeah, and if I can give you another example, I don't know what they call it in Korean, but you've probably seen this picture of a white background and a light blue Korean peninsula that is often sometimes shown around in popular demonstrations as a future Tongil ideal.
Right.
I don't know where this comes from, but I think that is exactly, I read that as an attempt to exactly get out of this dilemma of how do we ever incorporate if we do have political fortunate circumstances.
I want to ask you this question also. Go ahead.
I was going to say, so like some version of a united Korea flag that exactly jumps outside this debate.
This, of course, looking into like the far future
Exactly. Not tomorrow.
certainly not next week or maybe even next year, considering what's going on right now in the Korean Peninsula.
Yeah.
But that would be an interesting thing if, let's say, it comes to a case where the two Koreas were finally able to reunify. Okay. And I'm not sure they're going to be using that flag that we're very much familiar with. Like during the Pyeongchang Olympic Games, when the two Koreas had the joint women's hockey team.
Yeah, exactly. That's where I've seen this.
I don't think they're going to be going, well, we've used this before. Let's use this as a flag. I don't think that's how it's going to go. But like, I wonder if they would actually create a new flag or say we're going to go under this flag, the Tegaki, because it's always been here.
Precisely.
throughout the whole history.
I don't know, but there would have to be a conversation, although I can see, as you just said, a very legitimate case for saying, well, this goes back to the 1890s, goes back to 1883 as adopted.
Right.
Why not recognize that we can come back as kind of a moving outside the colonial narrative, moving outside our own division and kind of putting aside.
Yeah, and the argument could also be made, you know, I mean, it was you guys, North Korea, that created the flag. I mean, we had this flag for, you know, ages and so forth, but that's that. I think that's the least of the concerns at this time right
sure,
now
with, sure.
with North Korea. Going back here, how is the flag legally protected as an emblem?
Yeah, this is really interesting. And I say this as an American who knows that the American case is rather exceptional, mm-hmm. where sometimes damaging the flag has been seen and protected as a form of political expression. That is not the case here.
No.
So very much... I believe the definitions cover the obvious things like actually damaging it in whatever fashion. But even I believe, trying to interpret not being a lawyer, but reading some of the online stuff and reading other sources, defaming it. So I imagine if you were to, for example, put it in a piece of art or as a piece of clothing that were represented and interpreted by police as you're not doing it respectfully and you're doing it in a defamatory or trolling kind of way, that in theory you can be subjected to fines and potentially even prison. So very much respect and protection, both materially and symbolically.
Yeah, and that was the big question, because I've always been told, I remember when I was growing up in New York City, and a couple of my friends in high school, we decided to go to the Mets game. I know how much you love the Mets.
Okay.
From being that you're from the Phillies.
I'm smiling.
But it was. I'm not a Mets fan. The only reason why I went was Seo Jae-eung. He went by Jay Saw.
Oh, got it. So you had a player.
He had a Korean player.
No,
And then we said, you know, let's go watch him. I'm not a Mets fan, but, you know, I didn't even wear anything Mets. I came with a Korean flag.
Sure.
Right? And then I had carried it in a certain way. My dad, you know, he was lecturing me. You don't carry the Korean flag, the taegukgi, that way. You don't treat it that way. In fact, in Korea, if you wear the taegukgi, you could be subject to a fine because you're not allowed to do that.
I didn't know that, but it makes perfect sense.
Right. And then
yeah,
I said to myself,
which fits with the thing about defamation. And yeah.
And I said, wait a minute. During the 2002 World Cup and other World Cups, I've seen women wear the taegukgi in a certain way. And how come that wasn't...
I'm just assuming that in that context and the nationalist fervor. Yeah,
it wasn't defaming the flag.
Precisely. It was probably seen as an exceptional case. But you're absolutely right. I mean, the other place I've seen it, when Chung Hau Park pitched regularly for the Dodgers, you would regularly see people in Southern California express their Korean pride in the United States in a way that was probably seen as a positive.
And I love that. And you made a very good point. You talked about Chung Hau Park and so forth.
Yeah, that was my immediate context. I never saw him pitch, but whenever he pitched, you would see the numbers go up.
And now we see the Korean flag everywhere else. I mean, there's more Korean players now pitching and hitting in the MLB.
And in the Premier League in soccer.
Premier League, exactly. And the fact that you make a good point with the Premier League, with Son Heung-min's playing with Tottenham, there's fans of Tottenham fans who are carrying, lifting up the taegukgi, but they're not Korean.
Oh, and I did not know that. But it makes perfect sense. Okay.
They're not even Korean, right?
Yeah,
and so it's
yeah.
like, wow, you know, how far it's gone. But I love this. And if you think about, again, the long history of this and how it was able to go through a colonialism and so forth, and still what it is. But the design, like you said, a little bit different. For our listeners out there, if you have a chance, go check out some of the older designs of the taegukgi.
It's slightly different. I was going to say, the size varies a little bit. The field and the proportions will vary. I mean, you'll recognize it, but it's definitely slight changes.
Absolutely. Professor De Moya, as always, thank you very much for your history lessons today. Have a safe rest of the week, and we'll see you again next week.
Thanks very much.
You can listen to Korea Now with me, SJ Lee, by downloading the Arirang Radio application or tune in online by visiting www.arirangradio.com. So make sure you tune in Mondays through Fridays, 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. Korea time.